Hi, I'm Jim Pinkerton.
Hi, I'm Jeff Schmadrick.
And welcome to bloggingheads.tv, where our topic is Jeff's new book, The Case for Big Government. But then we'll go on from there to discuss how President Obama will be, and the Congress will be dealing with this, all the arguments and the realities in this book over the course of the next hour. So thank you for joining us, and thank you, Jeff.
It's a pleasure to be here. Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
Well, I mean, my immediate reaction here, I got the book from you, a couple months ago, and, the full extent of the economic downturn wasn't apparent, and the full extent of the kind of, at least for now, widespread acceptance of the notion of a huge expansion of the federal role was still sort of daring. So what I'm kind of curious about is, Jeff, you're as you sat down to write this book X number of months or years ago, you were writing it as a contrarian, as it were, and now it's become, dare I say, part of the conventional wisdom. So what happened? How did it happen so quickly?
Well, the X was a few years ago. It was based on lectures I did a few years ago. I did not expect this. And I should caution you, Jim, it's not what's happened is not exactly what I'm talking about. It's obviously aligned. But I wish I had come out 6 months sooner, because it looks like almost as if I'm after the fact rather than before the fact. Of course, as you know from looking at the book, all of this was done quite a lot sooner. I had believed for a long time, and clearly a lot of people disagreed, that the American economy was not doing that well. There were periods when it was doing that well, that it could do much better, that we were ignoring and neglecting vast areas that needed our attention, and that, in fact, historically, government has always been central both to equity, both to our values as Americans, equal opportunity, and so forth, and to prosperity. And I wanted to get that across as clearly as possible, heck or high water. It wasn't designed to time anything. And then suddenly here we're all talking in a matter of really 6 months, I guess, or 7 months, about using government in very aggressive ways to bail us out.
Right. Now, it's been quite a transition. But I think the history is interesting, and it's really not, as with almost any other element of American history, not commonly understood. I'll just ask a question just to kick things off to give our viewers just a little bit of context here. Why is Alexander Hamilton important for anything other than getting shot in that duel in New Jersey in 1805?
Well, all those guys back then were important one way or the other. But obviously, there's some mythology, I think, in the public mind, and I think in the minds of some economists who are often not very good historians, that there was once laissez-faire in America. But, of course, in Alexander Hamilton's time, and he was George Washington's first Treasury Secretary, he wanted a serious U.S. national bank to help control the quality, let's call it that, the solidity of the U.S. currency, and to pay back war debts. No small matter. That was a big matter in those early days. He was in favor of tariffs, unlike free market economists today, because he wanted to support manufacturers in the Northeast. He believed manufacturing was the future. He wanted to build roads. His principal opponent, as we know, was the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson. Now, everybody thinks of Thomas Jefferson as the laissez-faire guy. Keep government out. That's where the mythology began. But it was Thomas Jefferson, as all of us learned, who bought the Louisiana territories and doubled the size of the economy, not simply to keep the French and the Spanish away, and that was part of it, but to enable people to own land, because Jefferson saw owning land as a way to individual freedom and control. But Jefferson went further than that, if I can just go on for a minute, Jim.
Sure.
Jefferson, when he was governor of Virginia, insisted on regulations to sell that land, because he was afraid of land speculators, partly. And he wanted to make sure that land, which was owned by the colonies and then the states then, and went that when we signed the Constitution, it was ceded to the U.S. government, but Jefferson only wanted to cede the land the states owned if the U.S. government adopted certain regulations, making that land affordable, setting certain standards for that. So there were regulations in the sale of land. I use that as just one example. There were all kinds of regulations, by the way, in the colonial periods about how many hours you could work, what products you could make, and so forth and so on. But in any case, there's a long-winded answer to your question about Hamilton. There was always government in America. And sometimes we overdid it, and sometimes we didn't do enough. But when America worked best, it's when it used government pragmatically best.
I that's hard to argue with. You go back and look at those statistics and data from the 19th century, and I'm talking about the whole of the 19th century now. And you see the figure, you know, except for the Civil War, you know, federal spending as a share of GDP is like 3% or something like that. And of course now it's federal spending is like 20 or so, or 21 maybe, and then state spending is another 12 or so. State and local spending is another 12% or so on top of that, and so you get this sense of this enormous increase from then to now. But what I've puzzled over, and maybe you know, maybe this is just a question, is if one were to take a larger view of the role of government in terms of, okay, you know, how exactly do you quantify the Louisiana Purchase? I mean, you can count the number of dollars we spent to buy it, and count the number of acres we got from France. But in terms of sort of the share of GDP, or the share of mental GDP, if you will, that the Louisiana Purchase had, and then the construction of canals and railroads and turnpikes and, you know,
schools.
Well, okay, schools, sure. If one could say, as a matter of shorthand, that sort of the government today is a third of the U.S. economy or something like that, and maybe it's more than that if you count regulation. What was it back then? I mean, I just think it was, I'm sure it was a lot more than 3%. I'm sure just the challenge of getting a railroad and all the politics that said we're going to build the railroad from Albany to Erie as opposed to Schenectady to Erie or something. I mean, those choices that were made were profoundly important to economic development, back then, and were obviously, you know, major sources of politics and corruption. And I've always wondered whether somebody's ever attempted to get a handle on that so that we could get a better comparison of then and now.
Well, let's take railroads, for example. Half of railroad development in America was subsidized, according to the estimates, by federal government donation of lands. Now, the federal government owned most of the millions of acres of available land in the country. They owned it. They could have sold it and taken in the revenue. Instead, they gave it away to railroad companies, not necessarily always without corruption, I imagine. I'm not an expert in the corruption of that period, but they gave it away. That was, in effect, a major government expenditure that doesn't appear as a government expenditure the way it would today. That
right.
was a very good example of that. But
yeah,
when Thomas Jefferson didn't want to build canals and railroads at the federal level, and he changed his mind later in his second term, by the way, but early in that term he didn't, the state and local governments in his same party, the Republicans, the sort of the people who didn't trust government as much as the Federalists, the Hamiltonians did, it was the Republicans who went home and started building the canals by financing it, by raising, in effect, revenue bonds. We do revenue bonds today. If we totaled up those revenue bonds, they would, in effect, it was government guaranteeing those bonds. Thus, we built the Erie Canal, which made New York City what it is today. The shovel went in the ground, I think it was 1817 or 1818. It was finished in 1825. Many canals followed. Some things people know, there was primary education. People often don't think enough about the free primary education system in America that was started in the 1820s, started developing fully in the 1820s. By 1850, we were spending as much per pupil based on local property taxes and some tuition in those years as Prussia, the predecessor to Germany was spending per pupil, and more than France and England, and we had more kids of school age enrolled than they did already, 50, 60 years after America was started. That was government. Let me just say one other example. Cities only exist today because of the germ theory of disease. We develop sanitation systems, sewage systems, healthcare systems, and so forth, so people could live together without recreating the bubonic plague of the mid-1300s. That was the consequence of government, not private enterprise, but government expenditure on health, on healthcare systems in the late 1800s and early 1900s. It was called the Age of Sanitation. That led to the development of great cities, and cities, in my view, and in the view of people who have really specialized in this, like the late Jane Jacobs, cities were a great source of economic growth that conventional economists often leave out of the equation.
Just the role of a city in terms of turning a population into an educated workforce and so on.
An educated workforce, but no, also in terms of commerce.
Oh,
think about what happens when you walk down a city block looking at all those store windows. All that information and free marketing you get, and how easy it is for you to go in and buy a good. And those goods don't have to be transferred. And they can be the inventories can be central. All that information, all that agglomeration of ideas, all the reduction in the cost of transport, those are all great sources of economic growth. Maybe, arguably, almost impossible to measure, the greatest source of economic growth in modern industrial revolution.
So cities are good for business, just inherently.
In my views, they're good. They can get excessive. They can get inefficient. But often, you know, people, I always say, who uses the least energy per capita in America, and you know, what citizen of what city, and almost invariably nobody knows, but of course it's New York City.
Right, where relatively few people have cars and everybody can walk and take the subway and so on. It's hard to argue. About the 19th century, and then of course you get to the Republican. You mentioned Jefferson, the Republican. Of course, it was the Democratic Republican Party, although they called it the Republican Party, but what became the Democratic Party. And then the Republican Party, which was inherited from the Federalists and then the Whigs, was sort of avowedly, in its own way, a pro-business, big government party, I guess that's fair to say, right?
I would say that, yeah. Certainly Abraham Lincoln believed in central government. But, you know, his predecessor in that regard was Andrew Jackson, a successor to Thomas Jefferson. So that all gets a little bit complex.
Yeah, this issue of the banks of the United States. I mean, I guess there were two banks of the United States, right? And then before the Federal Reserve,
right?
Is that correct?
Was the Hamiltonian Bank, and then that was rechartered under Monroe?
Monroe or Madison?
It was either under Madison or Monroe.
1811, I think it was, wasn't it? Yeah.
And then it was ultimately the legislation to charter it again was vetoed by Andrew Jackson in 1834
right.
or 1836, something like that.
So in any case, it's hard to imagine a modern country without some sort of central bank. I mean, you know, and I guess the country ultimately came to that conclusion.
That's also a part of government. But sometimes people forget that. But anyway,
point. The existence of a central bank as an agent of the right. I mean, how do you count that as a share of GDP?
Regulation is hard to count as a share of GDP. You know, on balance, in my view, historically, it has had great benefit. Some regulations have not had great benefit, needless to say. But
right.
On balance, they've had great benefit. But it's hard. That's the point you're making, I think. You can't
count that as a
share of GDP. But government is there, nevertheless. Yeah.
So just to march right along here, I mean, now we come to the 1930s. And now just where do you come down on this argument about, you know, I mean, this, as you're aware, the New York Times this morning had an article about conservatives trashing the New Deal and saying, look, it didn't really work. And Amity Schlaes, who's now at the Council on Foreign Relations, has become a major figure in conservative circles with this book, The Forgotten Man, which is a pretty, I guess fair to say, slashing attack on the New Deal.
Yeah, I haven't read Amity's book per se. I guess I'd better, but The preponderance. I've read and a lot of Amity Schles. I think I understand her thinking. And I've chatted with her, and some form or other have debated with her. I think it's fair for me to say that probably that will simply not stand up, that it's a conservative pushback against what's long been accepted doctrine. I think it's very, very hard to make a case. And there are a couple of other papers, scholarly papers out there. I don't think of Amity Schles as a scholar in this regard, but that try to make that case about unionization hurting growth. But I think really, Frank, in the end, and I have not done the work myself, we are talking about a ratio of 500 good papers to one in favor of the New Deal having had salutary effects. That alone doesn't make the 500 correct, but I think this is a clear-cut conservative pushback, and it happens frequently. I think it's just too bad. There are lots of good conservative arguments and moderate Republican arguments that can be made, and this just isn't one of them.
Okay, and fair enough. So then we come to the sort of the present, if you will. And so if we stipulate that the dominant consensus of the 30s, 40s, into the 50s and 60s was that we're going to have a substantial federal role, and I think it would be fair to say that the cutting edge of federal government thinking shifted from infrastructure to income transfer somewhere during that period. I think that's and new concerns like civil rights and environmentalism came along. So if we were living in a world, why did it come undone so dramatically in the 60s, 70s, and 80s?
Well, it came undone in the 70s, I think. I don't think it came undone in the 60s. The New Deal represented the height of progressive movement, and the attitude continued, as you point out, into the new frontier of Kennedy and the Great Society of Johnson. We should always be clear, though, there was always conservative backlash in those years. FDR wanted a national health care plan, and the Republicans, who were regaining some political clout in the late 30s, nixed it, along with very aggressive politicking on the part of the American Medical Association. So there was always some backlash. In the 50s, there was lots of anger among Republicans with Eisenhower for building an interstate highway system, and Eisenhower wasn't all that progressive. But it came undone, I think, seriously in the 1970s, when we had this combination of inflation and serious recessions, persistent high unemployment rates, and a lot of economic pain. In that period, in my view, Americans changed their attitudes about government. History is complex. It wasn't only economics. I think it was principally economics. We could argue about those things. But people were very tired of Richard Nixon's Watergate. They were tired of the ongoing Vietnam War and the high cost to America in lost soldiers and in morale and in confidence and so forth. And the nation turned against government. Federal budget deficits at that point grew. And it became an easy case to make for traditional conservatives, Arthur Burns-type conservatives, and in a more extreme sense, a later Treasury Secretary, Bill Simon, who was a bond trader at Salomon, became much easier for them to make the case that government did it. There were government deficits, there was inflation, therefore cause and effect, government deficits mean inflation. Inflation is making you feel bad. Stop. You got to cut back government. At around the same time, if I can just go on for one sec, Milton Friedman, who was a very effective spokesman for his own ideas, in my view, which is, needless to say, a particular point of view, he was more effective as a spokesman than he was as an original theorist. But remarkably articulate, talented guy. His views started ascending. People like Reagan and Simon and so forth read his views. And they, by and large, conformed, not exactly, by and large conformed with this idea that government is making you feel bad. And then, of course, Reagan hit the nail on the head in 1980, and the rest is history. Mostly unfortunate history from my point of view.
Let's talk about Milton Friedman for a second. I mean, probably of all the free market, limited government, libertarian ideas that Friedman had, probably the academic idea that he's most associated with is that monetary policy drives much of the economy. I mean, I guess a fair way to put it, I guess. And that the Depression was a function of letting the banks collapse and letting the money supply fall, and that the governments are not smart enough to, you know, quote, fine-tune, unquote, the economy through tax cuts and spending. What they should do is just set a steady monetary supply level, announce it publicly, and then just sort of not do anything else, I guess.
Right. No, I think that's a good summary.
Okay, was he right or wrong?
Well, he was dead wrong. Partly the Federal Reserve did contribute to the Depression by maintaining too tight a policy. But here, the problem with in the early 30s, the Depression wouldn't have been as bad had they not, but we would have had a Depression anyway. The Depression, there was multi-causes to the Depression. Friedman's brilliance and his Achilles heel was always his simplification of matters. The problem is you can't control the money supply very easily. It's dependent on a whole bunch of factors, not just what the Federal Reserve wants to do. So in the early 30s, and I bring the early 30s up, what Friedman wanted them to do, he didn't even care about the banks. He just wanted the Fed to pump reserves into the economy, and that would raise the money supply. The way that works is you give banks reserves. That gives them the ability to lend money. But money is not created until they lend out. Those reserves allow them to lend against those reserves. They won't lend if they're worried about the economy, and nobody will borrow if they're worried that they don't have any business to build or that they won't be able to repay it. Well, guess what's happening right now? The Federal Reserve under Bernanke, who more or less lionized Friedman, I think it was less, but he liked to say it, has been creating reserves like crazy. Like crazy. People are worried about the reserves. I wish I had the number at the tips of my fingers. The money supply is growing just a little bit, and the economy is diving into recession. Now, don't take my word for it, okay? Friedman's monetarism was totally discarded by the Federal Reserve in the 1980s because it just didn't work. Now, does that mean the idea that big government might doesn't create inflation? It's a somewhat different idea. In my view, it can, but it doesn't always.
There are two different issues here. One, I mean, just to stick with Friedman for a second. I certainly agree that conservatives in the 70s and 80s were happy to conflate big government and, you know, monetary inflation as sort of the same thing. big government causes inflation. And I think that's obviously not correct. I think, but the issue, though, is not that big government causes inflation. The issue is that the same mindset that creates big government also, as a second phenomenon, creates too much money and tries to sort of inflate their way out of problems with sort of too many stimulus packages and so on. So the point's well taken that the economic policies of injecting, quote, liquidity into Citigroup or AIG or somebody in 2008 has enormous parallels to, you know, whatever was happening in 1930 or 31, and to not a lot of good effect. I think that. But let's just stay on the monetary issue for a second, because if Friedman is wrong, then where does that leave the people who are pushing inflation in the 60s and 70s? People, you know, the G. William Millers and so on back then, who and Arthur Burns, for that matter. Who seemed to, well, tolerated or encouraged or created a disastrous inflation that I think you and I both agree caused a significant discreditation at the time of Keynesian policies.
Friedman was wrong in saying that you could control the money supply, and the money supply had a direct effect on the GDP, direct causal effect. It was the cause of changes in nominal GDP. That's where Friedman was wrong. He wasn't wrong and would not have been wrong had he said monetary policy does have an effect on the economy, good and bad. It can expand the economy by lowering interest rates or creating more reserves, which go hand in hand. It can result in inflation if you do that too much, too fast. You can control the economy and contract it by raising interest rates and withdrawing reserves. But you can also affect the economy through fiscal policy by creating deficits and reducing deficits. Friedman oversimplified that process enormously, and I think to the detriment, 10 years of detrimental arguments. But that, so in that sense, I'm not disagreeing with you. There was overexpansion. The real overexpansion, I would argue, there was overexpansion under Johnson because he wouldn't raise taxes in 68 in Vietnam. But the big overexpansion, in my view, came under Nixon, and you mentioned it with Arthur Burns. Nixon put on price controls in August 71, then told his people, step on the gas, spend all the money you can before the end of the year, not the end of the year, but within 9 months, because I'm running for re-election in 72. And his friend Arthur Burns, as we well know, who he named chairman of the Federal Reserve, also cut interest rates. We got a big shot of potential, pent-up inflation, so to speak, in 72 as a consequence. Probably that partly led to the OPEC oil price increases, and the rest is history. So I'm not disagreeing that we can't step on the gas too hard, nor am I disagreeing that maybe Democrats found it too easy to step on the gas back in the 1970s. But that was not Keynes' argument.
Let's just say this: the people, the Reagan Thatcher Chicago boys, whatever you want to call it, revolution, counter-revolution, of the intellectually in the 60s and then in policy-wise in the 70s and the 80s, was, I think we agree, profound and worldwide. And it was a reaction to inflationary policies, not only in the U.S., but also across much of Europe, and then elsewhere in Latin America, including Chile. If you're a neo-Keynesian, if you're however you would define yourself, as we return to that spirit, at least we seem to be right now, what's the difference in knowledge that will keep a return from inflation from coming too?
The ultimate, let me just think this through for a sec. Number one, let me talk it through. The ultimate consequence of that period was extreme focus on keeping inflation low. That was probably to the detriment of increases in wages. That was probably carried too far. That was the consequence of Friedmanism. It wasn't, he would have accepted that. He would have been in favor of that. In a sense, Greenspan wanted inflation to be zero, but he just thought it should be 2% because inflation was miscalculated. But what also happened was a simultaneous belief in deregulation. Now, that was also, there were two Milton Friedmans. One was the serious theorist, let me get that out. The other was the popular policy writer. The Capitalism and Freedom, which I've always argued, published in 1962, is one of the most compelling economic reads in the history of economic book writing. It was a highly simplified version of Adam Smith, that laissez-faire is always better than regulation. Regulation, deregulation, was every bit as important as macro policy in the years beginning with Carter, carried through under Reagan, the first Bush, Bill Clinton, and the second Bush. That deregulation and that attitude, that laissez-faire attitude, led to remarkable periods of over-speculation, time and again. And I think one of the stunning comments by Alan Greenspan, and you remember this, I know, recently, was when he said, My model worked for 40 years. Remember when he made this apology?
Yeah,
40 years of experience, and it suddenly stopped working. Well, his model didn't work for 40 years. The government had to bail out the speculators and the financiers in 1987, the crash of 1987, in the late 80s and early 90s with the SNLs and that totally crazy deregulation of the SNLs where they allowed them to invest all that FSLIC-insured money in anything they wanted, shopping centers, ski lodges, and junk bonds galore. 1997, the Asian crisis, Thailand leading to Korea and even affecting Hong Kong, Indonesia, and Japan. 1998, Russia defaults. Brazil is jeopardized. Long-term capital management. Time and again, Alan Greenspan had to bail people out. And then he bailed us out again in beginning after the tragic events of 9/11 and cut the Fed funds rate between 2000 and 2003 from 6.5%, I think it was, to 1%. It made money free for these financiers, and they invested in these mortgage-backed obligations like crazy. And mortgage brokers were looking like mad. Who can we give a mortgage to next? And of course, and we know what's happened ever since. So that financial model didn't work. The government bailed those people out time and again. This time, things got so bad, it's not obvious that the government will be able to bail them out or not bail them out without a heck of a lot more pain and taking a lot of credit risk on the part of the U.S. government for the first time in your life or my life.
What was that last sentence again about the Mr. Last Sentence?
And jeopardizing, I don't think it's really jeopardized, but now we are at a point, not that the model has changed, that somehow Greenspan's model is no longer working because it never really worked because it always involved government bailout. But now things have gotten so dangerous and the structure is so badly impaired that we may not be able to bail it out without enormous damage in the process and the government taking on and the Federal Reserve taking on enormous amounts of liabilities which even threaten the credit quality of U.S. obligations. I don't think they will be threatened, but it's the first time in your lifetime or my lifetime where that's even a possibility.
Gotcha. All right, well, just we can wrap up on the history lesson here, and that is, and just say that, okay, the Keynesian model was discredited. I mean, Keynes, of course, died in 1946, so you can't blame him for this, but was discredited by the sort of the double-digit inflation of the 70s and the perception that stagflation, slumpflation had sort of set in, and that the old model of sort of trying to goose the economy with spending increases had sort of run its course. Now, is that a fair summary of the 70s?
I think a fair summary of the 70s was that you could not only use Keynesianism as a tool to guide the economy, that inflation could develop a life of its own. And that was not part of Keynesianism. Had Keynes been around, I think he would have suggested that was probably the case. In that way, Keynesianism was discredited. But as an idea that fiscal policy could affect economic growth, I don't think it was ever discredited. I think a lot of people claimed it was discredited.
I know, Argan. Here we are today. So let's talk about it. So what's your assessment of the current... You know, just today on Monday, it appears that President Bush is going to ask for the second half of the TARP funding, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which then President Obama, being sworn in 8 days, will build into place. So, how do you assess that the TARP program as it's being handled by President Bush and soon President Obama?
Well, I think you have to put it in the context of how bad things are. If Americans were saving about 0%, as you know, on balance, in other words, some people were spending a lot more than they earned, some people not saving very much, and it balanced that to zero. If the savings rate moves up back to 5% or so, which is what it was in the early to mid-90s only, and it used to be 8%, but it finally moves. That withdraws immediately $750 billion of purchasing power from this economy. It may well move up because consumers are so nervous and scared and saving for the future, worried about lost jobs, failed businesses, and so forth, number one. Number two, the wealth effect. Stocks and real estate have fallen somewhere between $10 and $15 trillion in value. Rough guess, say $12.5-13 trillion in value. People will stop spending because they're not nearly as wealthy. How much? That could also withdraw. $500 billion, maybe $250 billion. Nobody knows. Immediately, out of this economy is sucked $1 trillion. So we need, and that has a multiplier effect that builds on itself if it's sucked out. That's why people are talking about such a big stimulus program. So on the one hand, we have Obama only in the last few months talking about a big stimulus program, but he's not alone. Economists on Wall Street are talking about even bigger stimulus problems, even bigger stimulus. Then there's the TARP issue, the other $350 billion. The Paulson used $350 billion to provide capital to the banks in a program that I thought was poorly designed, I think made sense in principle, and was very poorly implemented, partly for ideological reasons. The other $350 billion, I think, has to deal with this default issue, because the proximate cause of this problem, it's not the first cause, but it's the proximate cause, is when housing prices started falling in early 2007, and then people started defaulting, and housing prices are still falling. If people still default, that will have further repercussions in the credit system. That will mean further deleveraging and fewer loans available and create a worse recession. So we have two problems. If the recession, this withdrawal of purchasing power, is not somehow offset, the recession could get even worse, and there will be more defaults on that account, not only on the part of homeowners, but on the part of corporations now, which would be a new tragic stage in this. Pounding the credit system. And then there's the other part. If housing prices keep falling, that will continue to add to defaults, putting more pressure on the credit system.
Is there anything to the argument that we've overinvested in housing and that it's kind of crazy to have houses as expensive as they are, and that there's a certain value in letting prices fall to some more rational level?
Yeah, I think we have overinvested, but the idea is to try to let them fall in some not plummet, but in some orderly way. So we don't, because when they plummet, it creates all kinds of extremely painful ancillary damage. I think people don't understand how many lives can be ruined in a very serious recession. Not just a pause in your career, but ruined. People losing their houses, people losing their jobs, careers ended, not just in pause. People never going to school again, marriages broken. We look back at, this is one of the things I find fascinating about economic history and about economists who don't have much interest in economic history. People look back to the 1800s and they say, well, you know, we didn't have this, we didn't have that, but we did okay. If you average out growth was pretty good, better than it ever was before. That's true. But the level of pain associated with that growth was enormous. The number of ruined lives was enormous. And we made great strides in dealing with that, in giving people decent lives. Not that we removed risk from their lives, but we started limiting it so it didn't undermine their futures completely. And we can't allow that to happen. We need some moderation here. But yeah, there are too many houses out there to answer that question.
Well, okay, but here's the question that the Austrian economists would say. Now, that's a distinct group from Milton Friedman, although obviously there's a fair amount of overlap. And that the argument made by Hayek and von Mises, you know, all through the 20th century was that the government just inherently isn't smart enough to figure these things out. That, yes, it's a good idea to have housing prices fall, but not by too much. It's a bad idea to have them plummet. It's a good idea, as you were saying, and I certainly agree, to have them drift down in some calm way. But the and you know, all of Hayek's and von Mises' books, sort of dwell on this point, sort of the failure of information, that people sitting in a marble palace somewhere will never get it, for lots of reasons, sort of institutional and mental, will just never get it right. And I think that argument has a lot of salience with the American people who are skeptical of the current federal government, ability to, do much of anything, whether it's, build public housing or fight the Vietnam War or fight the Iraq War you name it, the government stands accused. And I realize this is one of the reasons you wrote this book, the government stands accused of just simply not being competent. The people in the government aren't smart enough to do the noble work that you would assign to them.
Yeah, I think the people in Lehman Brothers were very smart, or Bear Stearns, or Merrill Lynch, or let's say Bob Rubin at Citigroup. I don't want to get impatient with that argument, but the errors in business are stunning, and the achievements of government are not uniform, but they are quite extraordinary. The building of the healthcare systems, the local high school just didn't happen. It was the best high school system in the world. It just didn't happen, and GE didn't build it. The local sanitation systems were extraordinary achievements. The canals, the Interstate Highway Department, the National Institutes of Health and all the money they give, the early on the space program, the technology coming out of defense. Let's get with it. And, let me bring up those bugaboos, Social Security. It costs about 0.5% in administrative expenses. And Medicare is loved by people who get Medicare. Look at the surveys. But let me get to that other question, which Hayek and Mises always ignore, neglect willfully. Markets are not rational devices. Markets, in cases of extreme, feed on themselves and lead to irrational and very painful levels. And they often need intervention for that reason. One person sells, especially financial markets. Financial markets are not a function of supply and demand. Housing, to some degree, is, but less and less so because it became a financial asset. Financial assets are estimates of the future. They are not grounded in supply and demand, and those estimates fluctuate wildly. Financial markets are not like the market for salt and sugar. And when economists neglect that, I see red. When they say, oh, you want the government to intervene, the market will find the price. The market does not find a rational price. And the evidence for that is just simply overwhelming in financial markets. They go way up and they go way down with no sense.
No, I agree. That's a good point. I certainly agree with you on the financial markets. But some of the examples you used, and I wasn't writing them down, you mentioned schools as number one. Well, now the schools are 18th in the world. You mentioned, you mentioned canals. I certainly agree with you that, canals and railroads, which were built through, by our reckoning today, a pretty corrupt sort of public-private process usually back then. But they did get built, and I think that's a stellar achievement for whoever we can assign the credit to them for. But, the argument is that, look, the government, the California government of Pat Brown in the 50s and 60s could make the schools in California and the public universities in California number one. And then something's happened. And again, the conservatives, the libertarians will trot out saying, look, the government officials of the last 30 or 40 years have gotten so caught up in fill-in-the-blank multiculturalism, relativism, sexism. They'll get on a list of needle exchange programs, whatever it is, that they've lost sight of the mission of actually pounding education into kids' heads. Now, is that fair or unfair?
Well, it's probably unfair, but I think that there's also probably, I think it's a mixed bag. I think there have been lots of inefficiencies. There have been lots of mistakes. It's this, this sweeping categorization of government as inefficient and bad that gets me a little nuts. If I were to say, what happened to the education system in California, you know what my answer would be, right?
If I were to Prop 13, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Prop 13.
The right. Well, I mean, but here's the question. How, I mean, in other words, as, you know, if one, you know, looks around at the current situation, and again, this America ranks, you know, 17th, 18th, 19th in education, what assurance... And again, my own view is that the quality of people, frankly, in the federal government has declined. That it no longer gets the best and the brightest to go work as bureaucrats at the Education Department or the Agriculture Department and so on and so on. You know, a lot of it's contracting. A lot of it's just people go to work for Lehman Brothers and, you know, or Boston Scientific or who knows where else. And so I myself, as a proponent of universal education, for that matter, universal healthcare, find myself a little queasy at the thought that the same people who can't seem to do it now are about to get a huge pay raise.
I'd love to believe that. What is the alternative? Maybe quality in America has generally declined. It would be very hard to argue that business has been extraordinarily well managed, with some exceptions. It would be hard to argue that there is not enormous waste in the university system. Many people don't like their churches. Maybe there's something else going on here. I haven't.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. That is worth dwelling on, because maybe, it's certainly, there's plenty of people who just sort of argue that we're a country of, you know, dopes, and, you know, and that the internet is, Google has dumbed us down. There's a substantial industry.
Can I just finish this one point? What's clearly happened, however, is that when this ideology, anti-government ideology, ascended, government got worse. People were put in charge who didn't care about government, didn't believe in government, didn't aggressively pursue government, use government as a stepping stone, you know, to an investment banking job. They weren't all Republicans, by the way. I'm always surprised to see a Democratic senator in an investment bank. You go to these fundraisers and so forth. But I think there has been a decline in the quality of government because of the ascendancy of an anti-government ideology and a kind of ascendancy, you know, that money is really what matters. Don't be a fool. Make money.
I agree with you. So what to do about that?
I think I'm trying to put this in a way that can't be corny. I have a little faith that Obama will bring the prestige of government back. I think it starts at the top, and it starts with the leadership. And you know the old story about, you know, the fish stinks from wherever.
Yeah, fish rots in the head, yeah.
So I think we've had a lot of people in charge who don't believe in government, and even the Democrats, when they were in charge, were increasingly believing less in government. And I think maybe this reversion to more normal compensation on Wall Street, where really most of the money was made either on Wall Street or through stock options to CEOs and venture capitalists and so forth. Maybe if that becomes more normal, I'm fighting a cold. If that becomes more normal, maybe there will be some evening out. Maybe we'll start to see some change in the values in the country. I'm pretty sure America has it in its capacity to improve this education system. But I also think a central part of my book, The Case for Big Government, is the government has to react to change. And things have changed enormously. The two-worker family is the standard today, and yet we have no national daycare high-quality pre-K system. We have knowledge changes. We know that how kids are nourished educationally and emotionally very early in their lives affects them. Government should be doing something about that. Government didn't know that it had to build high schools. It wasn't written on tablets on a mount. We figured it out because times changed and times required it. Didn't know they had to subsidize college. We figured it out. Didn't know we needed interstate highways. We figured it out. on some things we didn't figure, some things we didn't figure out very well, like public transit or health care. But I'm pretty confident we can deal with a lot of those if we choose to. I'm not so confident we will choose to.
That does remain to be seen. What would you do about one area I think that has hurt the cause of a effective welfare state is immigration. I think that the pattern is pretty clear that when immigration was wide open, there was no welfare state to speak of. When they began to close immigration in the 20s, the New Deal came along not long after, and I realized there were other factors as well, like the Depression and so on. A point made to me by a New Yorker, late Jim Chapin, who died in 2002, was that the opening, the Kennedy's Seller Immigration Bill of 1965 opened up the floodgates again on immigration after a 40-year hiatus, and there's no accident. And Jim was a leftist; he was a sort of an intellectual figure in circles, and actually went to a funeral service, a memorial service for him at the New School, and he was a pretty well-known guy in these circles. And his point was that immigration just wrecked the consensus for the welfare state, because you can't have a welfare state for strangers and non-citizens. You accept that argument, and then what implications does that have if you do or don't for the future?
Yeah, I think it probably to some degree undermines the consensus for the welfare state. I tend, as you might imagine, to be pro-immigration. I think it gives us enormous vitality. As a dweller in New York City, I find the most recent immigrants, on balance, the ones I see working in the supermarkets and the behind the counters and in various jobs around town, probably not all of them legal or even making minimum wage. I find them the hardest workers. Historically, immigrants have had enormous ambition. One of the advantages of immigrants is that they're younger and have more children, and will be able to help us support our Social Security and Medicare payments in the future. But I believe, there may be some grounds for some moderate control of immigration flows, but certainly not a drastic, let's close the doors utterly.
But you would agree that, just the way you said it there, that immigration does increase income inequality then in a country?
Immigration, I don't know, I haven't looked,
because
I don't
importing,
know the
you're
numbers,
importing,
but
poor people. You're importing poor people who, as you say, may not even make the minimum wage.
Well, those people are never counted because that inequality doesn't show up, so there's more inequality in the country than we know. But so I don't think that those are the numbers we're really looking at. Immigrant. I think I would like immigrants to have to make the minimum wage. I would be very happy about that. So I'm somewhere between you and the other point of view, probably. I do think there's some need for moderate control, but I think really immigration in America has been one of the great vital forces in the development of the
nation. Would you insist on legal immigration?
I don't. This is not an area I've written about, and I feel a little uncomfortable making bold pronouncements about it. So can I leave it at that philosophically?
But you would agree. I mean, it would be hard to, for example, to pass a national health insurance program that covered
all illegal. I think it would probably be hard. Yeah.
I mean, if the former Governor Spitzer of New York couldn't get a driver's license program through
it would be
New
hard
State.
To it would be hard to pass on. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. So, okay. Well, that's one. I'm sure they'll come up again. No doubt about that. So, are you optimistic then about the next, as we wrap up here, about the next 4 or 8 years under President Obama?
I believe it's a very. I believe the to-do list in America has never been longer. I believe the mountain to climb is very high, and I believe there's probably was no candidate out there who is more able to climb it than Obama. It sounds like I'm running for office, right? That doesn't necessarily mean I think he will be able to. He faces a big deficit, and a lot of people are afraid of deficits. In my view, in my book, I talk about after we get past this emergency, and I consider the economy not in a crisis but in a state of emergency, after we get this past this, I think we have to raise taxes on people, 3 or 4% of GDP, and it will in no way affect our productivity. That's one of the things I analyze in the book. That's my view in any case. So we can address some of these problems. I'm not so sure he will do that. I'm hoping he will do that. I will pound my fist on the table until they throw me out of the country in hopes people will do that. So I think there's an awful lot to do in the U.S. I'm not sure we will do it, but I think we can do it.
Okay. Well, listen, Jeff, I thank you. This has been very interesting. I think that this book, you know, raises a lot of challenging issues that that conservatives and everybody else are going to have to think about it. And that is, just this morning on at his press conference, President Bush said again, look, you know, I had to chuck out all my thinking, all my ideology, all my free market beliefs when they told me about the urgency of this economic situation. And
I missed that. I didn't see that.
Yeah, it was striking. Not that I would want President Bush to speak for me on much of anything. If to the extent that conservatives are going to have a counter argument to what you put in a very concise breezy to read book, if what they think goes out the window whenever there's a crisis, then what they think, or what we think, I should say, isn't worth very much. And so,
I hope this leads to constructive discussion and no finger pointing and blame. I think we just have to have a constructive discussion, and I very much believe we have succumbed to ideology, by which I mean a point of view based on a kind of faith, not on fact. I do not think it should be replaced by another ideology. I think it should be replaced, it's easy to say, I realize, but it should be replaced by a pragmatic sense of what our problems are, how they have changed from the past, and I emphasize that in my book, and how government has to be a part of making society and the economy work, and not discarded automatically for ideological reasons.
Jeff, you've virtually channeled there William James, and who in terms of pragmatics, and who said over and over again, look, when things change, we have to change.
One of America's great writers.
One of America's great thinkers. Anyway, Jeff, I thank you for taking this time with us. Good luck to you, and I'm sure that I'll make a request to the bloggingheads.tv high command that we revisit all the topics you raised a year from now or so, just to see where we stand then.
I would like to do that, and I appreciate the time and consideration. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeff.
Bye-bye. Bye.